Thank you all. First, I just want to express my gratitude to Rick for curating this festival and Fiametta for making it all happen. Just a round of applause for them. It's been a beautiful weekend. So we're going to talk about permission and all the things that you have to ask for permission for in your life. And some of these things you probably don't realize, and some of them you do. And we're going to talk about how technology can take away that need to ask for permission and actually how to practice it. And this is a talk, this is a conversation. So if you have a question, if you want me to repeat something, if you want me to go deeper into something you don't understand a concept, just raise your hand and we'll run a mic over to you. If you get bored, you need a cigarette, you need an espresso, you need to walk out, it's too hot. There's no judgment, no bad feeling. Everyone comes at this and at the time they need to come in. So don't feel bad about walking out and blowing this whole thing off either. We're broadcasting globally as well. And I'm super excited to be here to talk about this. So next slide. So everything you see on this slide, money, speech, and intelligence, today you have to ask for permission to interact. I'm sure you all have had an experience of going to a bank and you put money in and you put more money in and you put more money in and then you need the money and you need to take some out and you need to talk with someone about taking out. In some cases, they may block you from taking that money out. In some cases, they may hold the money. In some cases, they say, well, I don't know where the money went. It's disappeared. But to even participate in this economy today, you need permission. You need permission from your government to actually use the currency that you have in your pocket. You need permission from your bank, of course. And every single person you interact with also requires that permission, just to participate. There's no freedom in this. It's all friction. And some of that friction is good to minimize fraud and minimize criminal activity, but most of you in this room and online have to pay a pretty significant cost to protect against those things. The next one is speech. So today, it's a lot easier to speak freely, and you have tools to do so, but you're still going to a site, to an app. You're putting your name in, your email address, your phone number. They're checking this information. They grant you permission, they grant you a slice of their platform for you to express yourself. If you're trying to get your message out to the world and you go through media, you have to get permission from the media, whether that be a journalist or a reporter, or time on the channel, who's paid for by their advertisers. So just to speak, and even to speak point to point, peer to peer, through iMessage or WhatsApp or Signal, in many cases, these accounts can be shut down if you don't do the right thing, if you don't follow policy. And you could be the best actor in the world in terms of following all the rules and following all the policies, and these systems may make a mistake and shut down your account, making you have to go to the company or go to the service and ask for permission to get your account back. Intelligence is one that's on the horizon. Now, a long time ago, intelligence was kept in the church before the printing press. In order to get to the intelligence, and what I mean by intelligence is not the intelligence of yourself, but true intelligence, which is from a network, from a group of people, from a community, from society, all coming together to advance humanity. In order for you to read the scripture, for instance, or to read the latest science, you had to get permission from these institutions. And the printing press opened that up. The institutions fought heavily against that for hundreds of years. The internet has opened that even more. But now this is all about to change because of AI. AI has the ability to look at all the written intelligence that we've ever put forth in humanity, all the images, all the video, all the media, and bring it together in aggregation and understand it in a way that you as an individual would never be able to understand. But a company who is putting these things together can understand. So this right here is a picture of a drawing of a neuron, and there's millions, if not billions, of these in your brain, and individually they do nothing, but taken together, they have created every single thing that you're aware of, every single thing that you can think of in the future, everything you can dream up. And all of these systems, all of these permissions, are based on networks of these very, very simple cells. Next slide. So who do you have to ask for permission from? Number one, we discussed a little bit, which is the government. The government is very similar to number two, which is a corporation. The difference is the government has a monopoly on violence. It has an army. It can force you to do things through weapons. While you may think you own a piece of property or you own a piece of clothing or anything that you feel like you have ownership over, it's actually just a lease from the government. They're giving you permission to continue to own it. They can seize it at any point. If you do something that is against their policy or against their laws or against their rules. So there is no true ownership with this monopoly of violence. A corporation is a little bit different. It's actually considered to be a citizen with the rights of a citizen, but has super rights as well, which reduces the liability on individuals and puts them into this abstract shadow. So they can do things that a government necessarily couldn't do, an individual couldn't do. And a lot of the power of those permission sets that we talked about, money, speech, and intelligence, are going into corporations. So almost every interaction you have today through your phone is backed by some company. And that company has one person ultimately who is leading it, and that one person represents a single point of failure. If the government wants to coerce that person, they can put pressure through their monopoly of violence, and they can force that CEO, force that leader of the company to do things that they want. All these corporations have business models. They have profit incentive. You are not their customer, especially within social media. You are actually the product. The advertisers are the customer. And when the advertisers want something done, and they say, if you don't do this, we're going to pull our advertising money, and it hurts your business, those corporations are going to act. And you see this in traditional media, and you see this in social media as well. The final entity that you have to ask for permission is yourself. We build up identity, we build up ego, we build up an understanding of how people relate to us and think about us. You've heard this term cancel culture and what it means to be judged by the culture or be judged by society or be judged by a community. And that is this implicit permission that you're forcing yourself to do. You're not going to do certain things because you fear potentially how it might build up your identity or take away from your identity or your reputation. And what I'm going to talk about for the majority of this talk is how you take that back, how you become more self-aware, and how you recognize where you're asking for permission and where, through better technology, you can build it for yourself. This is the original block. It's called the Genesis block for Bitcoin. And this is really interesting because it's an intersection of all these three things. Satoshi Nakamoto is a person or a group of people that we don't know who it is. It's a pseudonym. This person, when they created Bitcoin, they created the first Bitcoin block, and they wrote some text in it. And the text reads, "The Times, January 3rd, 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout of banks." So this is talking about the 2008 financial crisis into 2009, how the government had to bail out a corporation, and who paid for it? The consumers. There's a lot of interaction between one and two, because between governments and corporations. And this is the thing that I think is the most worrisome thing as we move into the future, and we consider where true power is and how much it's in the dark and how much we can't see and how much we don't have control over, even with a vote, because a lot of it is hidden in that connection and a lot of it is placed on the corporation side. Next slide. So why is it important to seek permissionless technologies, to do things more for yourself, to not be dependent upon asking for permission from governments or companies? There's three here. This is just a small segment of the needs, but activists, human rights, they're often under significant surveillance, significant blocks from their governments. One example, there was a protest called End SARS in Nigeria against police brutality. The government told the corporation, the bank, to shut all of the accounts down for every activist that it determined. So they basically had no money to eat. They had no way to get money. They had no way to spend money, shut down their cards, shut down their accounts, just because they disagreed with the opinion of these people. And that's just a light example of what a human rights activist has to do. This is a picture of Edward Snowden, who is a hero of mine. I think took one of the most courageous acts you can imagine, gave up everything to share with the world how much the CIA and the NSA was spying not only on Americans, but citizens globally without court orders, and how much information they were able to take. And his disclosure changed very little about how these governments and intelligence agencies act. It did increase the need and the desire for people to have encryption, which is a huge, huge win, but it's not enough. There's still many, many methods they can use to surveil and to invade your privacy. Science is another one. Science is always on the brink of discovery. There are some discoveries that threaten governments, threaten corporations. We've all had crazy experiences during COVID where you saw a lot of different opinion and a lot of opinion shut down or minimized because of government asks, corporate asks, the pharmaceuticals. So we need to make sure that in all of these things that advanced society, that we don't have as many blocks, because we never know where these things are going to land and what the outcomes are going to be. And of course, the reason we're all here in this town of Castellet, art pushes the boundary. It finds truth, it finds meaning, it finds purpose. And it's very hard to do that in policies. It's very hard to do that when you have to ask for permission. You have to be free. You have to understand. You have to go to your darkest depths and society's darkest depths and highest highs to really understand. And it's not comfortable for a lot of people and a lot of institutions, corporations, governments, even yourself. So these things tend to be shut down and not seen, unfortunately. So this is a why. Are we going to the next slide? So now we'll get into the meat of everything, which is the how. So Bitcoin is a form of digital cash. So if you had the euro in your pocket, the dollar in your pocket, and it was digital. In 1970, most of the world, their paper money was actually backed by gold bullion. So there was a one-to-one backing between gold. In 1970, Richard Nixon removed that backing and said, we can print money, and we can print as much as we need. And the cost of that printing is a thing called inflation. So as you print more supply, the value of all the individual monies in circulation today goes down. And this whole system of money is dependent upon two major parties. One, the government to issue the money, and two, corporations to actually make sure there's no double spending. So if I spend a dollar, it has a very specific serial number. If someone counterfeits that, they can double spend it, and then that dollar and that transaction is worthless. So the problem to solve, to remove the dependency on governments and corporations, was this double spending problem, to make sure that a transaction is only, and a piece of currency is only used once. Satoshi Nakamoto solved this one problem, which is the double spending problem, And he solved it in a way by using a proof of work model, which means you have a computer. And you can think about it like if you take someone's phone in this room and they have a password on their phone, you go through every single combination to unlock that phone. These mining computers, they're mining Bitcoin like they would mine gold, are looking at this big string of number and they're trying to find the match. They're trying to guess the password. So you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of computers trying to guess the password. And the faster they go, the more, the faster they can guess it. And it's all using electricity. So you're converting electricity into finding this this password. Eventually one computer will find it. And when that one computer finds the correct match, a Bitcoin is mined. And in this particular time, 3.25 Bitcoins are mined. So you proved that you did the work to create the value of the Bitcoin. And the Satoshi also put another constraint on Bitcoin, which he said, there's only gonna be 21 million Bitcoin. And what that means is it's a constrained set. So there can never be any more printing of Bitcoin, although you can devise them almost infinitely. So you don't need to own one Bitcoin, you can own a bit of a Bitcoin and spend it. And what that means is you've built a deflationary currency. So instead of inflating the currency, which is an invisible tax, making all your money less and less valuable, you have a deflationary currency where as time goes on, it continues to increase in value because it's more valuable to people and they get they understand like how it can be used and what it can be used for. And just by that, as you hold Bitcoin, it goes up instead of going down. And it can only go up because of this 21 million coin constraint. Now it has variations over time, but if you look at the close to 15 years of its existence, 2009, you only see it going up and that will continue. The last Bitcoin will be mined, that last puzzle will be solved in 2140. And after that, all of the supply is there. You can't create any more, but you can divide it into smaller bits and actually utilize it. The reason this is important and why he solved this problem is now we don't have to go to a bank to say that this transaction is valid. It's tens of thousands of computers who are constantly validating the transactions. You don't have to go to a government to issue the money because the computers are doing it themselves. And there are three, there's no leader, Satoshi has disappeared. There's no one company that owns this. There's no government that owns it. It evolves very slowly and very deliberately, like you want your currency to evolve, through three parties, the miners, the people that find the Bitcoin and secure the network, the node runners, who are looking at all transactions and securing them as well, and the developers. These are people who are principled, who want money, who want people to be free of these permissions and these dependencies, and are doing it out of the goodness of their heart, and they also have some Bitcoin, so they're making some money. But these are people who actually want the best for the world in a decentralized way. This is important, so if a government or a corporation tries to attack one thing, they have to go after every single computer in the Bitcoin network, and it's effectively impossible to do. So this makes it resilient, and it makes it usable by the activist, by the artist, and by you all. Now, right now, Bitcoin is seen as a store of value. It's seen like digital gold. You buy some, it goes up in value, maybe it goes down a little bit, then it goes up, and maybe you sell it, and you buy something that you need. That's in most Western countries. In Central America and South America and Africa, they're using Bitcoin to send money across borders to family because it costs almost nothing to do. They don't have to talk to Western Union. They don't need to get permission. They can send money directly to their family and it's received instantly. They're actually using it for payments as well. They don't consider the price of Bitcoin. They're just considering the utility. This will happen more and more Western countries as we see things and as we see these dependencies and the need for these permissions as time goes on. But it's going to take some time. It's not 10 years, it might be 15, but little by little, people see the value of this system and why it's so powerful and why it could potentially be a complement or replace the US dollar, which rules everything and is currently being challenged by the Chinese yuan. These are two entities that control your money, control the value of your money, and you don't elect them. Whereas Bitcoin, you have a lot more control and you have a lot more free agency around it. So that's money. Speech, there's been a number of attempts to free speech and to do it from a technology standpoint, not at the benefit or the benevolence of a CEO, but something that can't be corrupted because the technology can't be corrupted. Nostr is one of those technologies. It's built with similar principles as Bitcoin. It's not a blockchain, but it's completely decentralized. There's people all around the world running servers, and to attack any one particular person or the entire system, you have to go to every single one of these servers and wipe out the content or take the account down, which is impossible. The most interesting thing about Nostr is it gives your data back. It actually has you own your identity. So you've all had the experience of going to social media, putting in your email address, putting in a password, and then if you try to move it, it's extremely challenging. You don't own that data, the company owns it. So when you put your phone number and your password in, they're looking up a record, looking at all your data, pulling into it, serving it to you, and then you do what you need to do. In Nostr's case, you get two keys. You get a secret key, which you hold privately, and you get a public key, which you can give to anyone. And with that public key, you can share it and anyone can find you. With a secret key, you actually sign your messages. So only you can unlock your messages and only you can sign your messages or your videos or your images or your documents or whatever it is. So you have true authenticity. You're not relying upon a company to say, this is Jack. It's actually yourself, and it's all a function of you storing that key and keeping it safe. And what that means is with Nostr, you can log in to any social media client with your secret key, and you have all of your data, and you can move it anywhere you want. The important thing is you own it. They can't take it away from you. They can't shut it down. And they can't hide particular things or add things after the fact. So this is really, really important in the age of AI, where in a few years, 5, 10 years, you are not going to know the difference between something that is real and something that is fake. We need technologies that you can actually sign and you have the authenticity to do so, and only you to do that. And that's what something like Nostr looks like. I'm going to share how to sign up for all these things in a bit. The third is intelligence. We have about 5 or 6 companies who are building these large language models. They're closed, most of them are closed models. You don't understand and can't understand how they work. These companies hold the keys. They have all the data. They're taking all of your information and they're utilizing it to training these models, both external public information and also private information. And how many of you have used ChatGPT, just by a show of hands? So what's interesting about this is you're typing questions in, and you're typing ideas, and you're having a conversation, you're getting frustrated, you're showing emotion. This is learning every single thing and building this model upon that data. Like, if there is a sense of a true global consciousness, it is this right now, because it's getting everyone's frustration into a system. It's getting all of their emotion. It's getting everything they create, all the light stuff, all the dark stuff, negative, positive, and it's seeing everything. But there's only one person who can actually see all those things, and it's the CEO of these companies. And because these are getting more and more trust, you're actually asking them questions on what to do, and they direct you. And by default, your bias will be to follow it. And that means those algorithms in the background can eventually change and be manipulated, and that means a much larger portion of society and globally can actually be manipulated into things that a government or an institution wants them to do. And you have to keep in mind, these all have business models. They need to get paid to stay relevant. They need to grow their profit to stay on Wall Street and continue to increase their value. They don't care about you. They care about that number going up. So what's the answer to this? We need more open source AI models. Fortunately, there's a huge community of really principled programmers and engineers and designers who are building these systems so that we don't have to rely upon the intelligence of corporations, that we can build these ourselves and we can understand them ourselves. There's a lot of conversation these days about free speech and the importance of free speech. And I think that is a complete distraction. The question and the debate and the conversation that we should be having is around free will, because these algorithms are being used to direct your attention and in some cases direct your action. And we have all experienced TikTok, Instagram, X, Pinterest, whatever. You're going there and you're seeing what the algorithm is programmed to have you see, which is really optimized around one thing: which post is going to get the most number of impressions so that I can put the most advertising behind it. It all goes back to the money. Follow the money. So even with these systems, we need a way to turn these algorithms off so we can see everything, or to choose our own algorithms, or to build our own algorithms and share our algorithms with our communities so that we have a better understanding of what this thing is doing and what it's showing us and where it's pointing our attention and where it's pointing our ultimate action. These are black boxes. Not even the companies necessarily understand how they work. And that's really scary, especially because we can't participate in the building. But we're getting to a place where we actually can, and that's super exciting. Next slide. So when does this all happen? Like, this is a ton of information. It feels super abstract. Doesn't feel like you can walk out of this room and actually do anything. There's three paths. A lot of people start with experimentation. So they hear about Bitcoin because it's going up and it's going this crazy price. They buy a little, they're not really sure. They heard about this Nostr thing or Blue Sky or Farcaster, and they like the principles behind it. They like the idea, but not really sure. A lot of people drop off right there. And this is a perfectly fine outcome, just to experiment with it. But it's often the case that people get to number two, where they have to react to something that happened. Their bank account was shut down. Their money was frozen. A post was taken down from social media. Their account was banned. They need another place where they don't need to ask for permission from the government, from the corporation. And that's where these technologies come in. And that's where there's more of a need to find them. And then the third, which is very approachable if you decide to do it, is to make a decision to actually explore these things. And there's no better time than right now. We're at the solstice. These are new beginnings, new changes. And this is what we're all experiencing in this weekend, is just to push our mind a little bit, just to learn a little bit about what's out there and what we have access to and what enables us more instead of diminishes us, especially in art. How can I enable myself more, especially as a musician? How can I own more of my relationship with my fans, even my money? These systems are built to be predatory and take and take and take. So I offer three practices. If you go to the next slide, and then the next slide. So the number one thing is just to be mindful, to be aware. Spend one day, take a journal, a piece of paper, your digital notepad, and write down every service that you interacted with and what you think you gave them or what you think they took from you and what you actually got back from it. It's a very simple practice. Just be aware and just write those things down. And then start trying to understand, like, what do I actually need? And try to minimize your footprint. Do I need this particular account? Is understand one thing is your trade-offs. These are all trade-offs. Oftentimes you're trading convenience for privacy. It's really that stark. We're biased towards being comfortable. We're biased towards maximizing our convenience. And the cost of that is privacy. And the cost of that are these services that utilize our data for their own needs and for their own profit. So duplicate everything you do for a little bit. It can just be very small. Just pick two areas. Maybe it be money, maybe it be speech, maybe it be something else. And third is don't trust verify. So even this talk, everything I've said, don't trust me. You have to experience it yourself. And you have to learn yourself. And this is going to be so critical as we enter this time in the next 5 years to 10 years, because the way that images are created, deep fakes, videos, you will literally not know what is real and what is fake. It'll be almost impossible to tell. It will feel like you're in a simulation because everything will look manufactured, everything will look produced. And it's very important that you shift your mindset, or you attempt to shift your mindset, to verifying the things that you feel you need through your experience, through your intuition. Because all these devices in your bags, in your pockets, they're offloading from that image of the neuron I sent you. And because all these things are on your phone now, you're not building those connections in your brain anymore. You're building an absolute dependency on these devices every single time you use them. You're removing the connections from those neurons in your brain. You're removing the connections from the people around you, your family, your friends, your community, your city, your nation. And be mindful of that. And you're being asked by these entities, by these corporations, by these governments, by these technologies, trust. Follow this. This is intelligence. This is all understanding. This is truth. But the only truth you have is what you can verify yourself with your own experience and with your own connections. But just being mindful of that is the most important thing. So next slide, and this is my final. If you take out your phone and point it at this QR code, it will, and you don't have to do this, by the way, give yourself permission if you'd like. It will open a page called primal.net, which is a Nostr client. And you can download it to your iOS device. You can download it to your Android. You can use it on the web. The reason I point this out is if you just play with this, you'll get an understanding of the new way to log into these services, how you might own your data. But importantly, Bitcoin is built right into this. So you can actually buy $5 of Bitcoin and you can use it to send money to a post you like. You can actually do micropayments on the internet right now. If someone puts up a beautiful photo, you can send them 2 cents. You can send them a penny, whatever you think it's worth. This completely changes how commerce is done on the internet. This completely changes and removes the dependency upon an advertising model, which is really, really important if we want truth in media that can't be corrupted by money and by advertisers and the corporations behind them. So it might feel a little bit odd and a little bit like a wild place because it is brand new, but it's worth just playing around with it, see how it feels, because it is coming. And it's just a matter of time and when we all decide to do it, when we all decide to remove these dependencies, because we believe more in humanity than these companies and corrupt governments and how they interact with each other. And that's my talk. Any questions? There were no questions during, so I'm assuming all of you understood all of it. Do we have a mic? Oh, sorry.
Thank you. That was great. You might not have an answer to this, but for someone who's thinking about buying Bitcoin for the first time, historically there seems to be these artificial inflations due to hype. And then some kind of normalization. If one is thinking about buying it, there's kind of this innate fear that when you want to buy it, it's overinflated at that moment and you don't know. Any sense of how long someone needs to hold one for it to normalize and feel like it's going to be okay?
Anyone who has the answer to this question is lying, because it's completely unpredictable. There's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of emotion. Any stock market is really just an emotional voting machine. They're just expressing belief in the company or belief in the system. But I would just point you to a long-term view. Look over 5 years or 10 years and look at the general trend and decide for yourself. And the value of Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is very different from all other cryptos. It's the only one that has the properties to be a currency, in my view. Everything else has some scam aspects to it. And people are, there's individuals behind them trying to make money. Individuals that can actually be called before the government and questioned or detained or jailed. Bitcoin has none of those things. So it's important to pick one with those properties, but you know, you buy a little and then you may need it for a rainy day and you may need to use it. And don't feel bad about selling it, because one day you'll be able to buy more and it will continue to go up and up and up over time. And I don't think it'll ever necessarily normalize. What will be normal is it continues to go up because of the scarcity.
On multiple instances, you've mentioned governments, corrupt institutions who hold the power. How would you say the conundrum is solved when these indie developers or coders who have a code of a moral compass today that aligns with this vision you're talking about, how do you prevent them from becoming the rulers then? Do we need to keep shifting to newer, more, let's say, indie people who...
Yeah. No, great question. So typically developers have a CEO above them that directs them to what they do. In Bitcoin case or in the Nostr case, anyone can make anything. You don't need the permission of a CEO to build something and to ship it. You just build it because you want it. And then it's a function of who wants to use it. And it's really just a market-based dynamic. If people disagree with what the developers are doing, they go somewhere else and they use something else. In Bitcoin in particular, there's three parties that decide where Bitcoin goes. And it's a very, very slow process. It's the developers who put something out. It's the node runners who run the software, and they can choose to upgrade or not because they like or don't like what the developer did. And then the miners who are mining the Bitcoin, and they run similar software and ascribe to similar policies. And any one of these three can try to do something, and it's tried in the past to go in a different way. And the other two parties might say no, or one of the two parties might say yes and agree, and the network shifts. So this three-entity consensus model keeps everything in check. But it's all open source. You can see it, you can take the source code, you can build your own, and if you can convince people to use it, then that becomes the winning option. Whereas you can't do that with a government, because it has to be voted, it has to be at the mercy of a president, a prime minister, a dictator, whatnot. There's a lot less participation in that model. One in the, all the way in the back.
I don't know. We're coming with a microphone from the side.
Jack, thank you so much. Very insightful. My question is, on your first slide, you put up three things, money, speech, and art. And in the first two ones, it's very obvious that decentralization is such a big principle to make it more open and permissionless. In the third one, in art, what are your thoughts when you put, you know, decentralization against the concept of stars or thought leaders, you know, in art and in pop culture or culture, we still have the big, you know, the big principle of, you know, personified paradigm shift. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was money, speech, and intelligence. I consider art to be more in the speech category, and I think these technologies level the playing field a lot more, so everyone can start at the same place, and it doesn't favor any particular one. So you still have to earn an audience, and you still have to do something interesting that people love, because ideally you love it and you want to see it in the world, and it resonates with other people because it hit some deep foundational nerve. The deeper it is, the broader the attention is in humanity, in my view. So that doesn't really change. But what does change is how artists can be paid. And they don't necessarily have to go through a label. They don't necessarily have to go through a particular agency or an auction house. They can actually get the money directly from the people who love it, from their fans, from their clients, from people who appreciate them but may not own the work. So opening that door gives artists a lot more freedom, and it gives them a lot less burden to worry about, because they can really focus on their creativity instead of all the mechanics of money and bank accounts and all these other things around them.
How does proof of work equate to value?
Proof of work is that concept where all these machines are trying to solve this puzzle, effectively just guess this password. So you plug in a machine and one of these computers into the electricity. You're paying for that electricity. That electricity is converted into this algorithm that is trying to solve this puzzle and guess this password. And as it does, as that Bitcoin is found, it goes onto the blockchain, and your computer can actually prove that you paid for the electricity, you did all the hashing work to actually find it, and you can mathematically prove that you own that Bitcoin and you deserve and were rewarded that Bitcoin, and then you can sell that Bitcoin. This is not for most people. This is miners. Miners are constantly using these machines to find Bitcoin, and then they sell them to exchanges, and individuals buy the Bitcoin off those exchanges. And that's where you see the prices go up and down. If there's more people buying, it goes up, and if there's more people selling, the price goes down, and it tends to mediate. But the way you can think about it is just simply converting electricity into value and proving that you did that through a mathematical equation.
I just had a question. It's like more in a third world context. My wife's family's from Haiti. We do a lot of work in Haiti. And someone made a very generous donation of, cryptocurrency. And just because of the infrastructure of the NGO, it was very difficult, like just the volatility and also even just getting the money out to translate to pay teachers in rural Haiti, or like just that connection between like places without some of this infrastructure or technological infrastructure. It's been like the people to manage even just the money that hasn't really been able to be seen by anyone. It was just more of a, I don't know if it's just like growing pains or whatever, but it's just like that was like a very real frustration. I was just curious if in that context, if you have anything to speak to that.
It's really difficult right now. The on-ramps and off-ramps to Bitcoin are extremely challenging. Once you have it, it's fairly easy. But a lot of the work right now, a lot of the work that my company is doing, and I fund a lot of individual Bitcoin developers and Nostra developers, what they're doing is focusing on accessibility and how we make it more understandable, how we design it better, how we make it so that people can use it immediately. But right now you have to find a local exchange to sell it. And whatever the price is, and that determines how much you sell and how much you keep. As I said, over time, the more you keep, the more it's valuable. But you might need it, in the moment. And in order to do that, you just need to find an exchange. And
Things that are presently needed,
yep.
Like emergency situation, you need to get money to services,
yeah.
to staff, to people.
Yeah.
It's more like that, that was more.
Yeah, you have to go to an exchange to sell it, and then that converts it to fiat. And even that exchange is a company, right? And they need to convert it to fiat, and you have to ask them permission to do so.
Right.
Right, so when it's a fully Bitcoin world, that permission goes away in many cases. But right now, we have these on-ramps and off-ramps that we have to deal with.
Great.
And they're still building.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe we do one last question.
Thank you.
That's right here.
This is like an invitation to discuss something. When I think about a world of completely free speech, whether it's a communication app or something like that, it's beautiful to think that you can speak about anything, but then also you can speak about anything in any way. And there are reasons why some subjects are controlled more, they're legal, etc. How would you think it would be possible to balance complete freedom of speech with unethical and legal topics?
Yeah. I think giving people more agency, allowing them to choose their own, where they direct their attention. And I think people are inherently good and inherently want to see good things. Obviously, there are people who are doing very negative things in the world. And in many of these systems, like they're not completely hidden. There are many ways to really understand and understand these behaviors and observe them and try to shut them down still. But the default should be I get to choose where I put my attention. And that is what increases, and that is what grows. And all that other speech still exists, and I can still find it, but it's diminished because I'm not paying attention to it. I think it's all about attention, and that's really the conversation. It's not about free speech, it's about attention, because a lot of that speech is out there, but it's what these algorithms want to point you to. That's what you're reacting to. And in many cases, this very negative stuff that you're seeing, they're pointing to you to it explicitly because it's a crazy headline or it's a crazy thing and it gets tons of impressions and that means more advertising dollar. So it's incentivized inherently to make sure that there's more controversy that you react to and you just like doom scroll forever just feeling bad about the world when it's really just how do I optimize to get as much advertising dollar as I can. Attention. Okay. Thank you all. Go enjoy the world.